Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Now, we are really amazed here at X Squared Radio that you are here on such an absolutely gorgeous day, live, July 25th, 2010, as we make our way through this blazingly hot, record-setting summer. Out riding my motorcycle today, it was like riding behind a blow dryer on the freeway. I actually saw a bird just lift off of one of the power lines near the freeway and just burst into flames. Definitely hot today. The solar wind tonight is up to 440 kilometers per second, and the proton count is also up, almost 4 protons per cubic centimeter. So if you're out and about in the sunshine today, I know it might be a little uncool, but you might want to put some of that Sunblock Schedule 80 on, otherwise known as blue jeans, to protect yourself from damage later in life. Sunspot 1089 was a suspect for flares, but it is large and quiet while it faces the Earth. So far, so good. We are sort of crossing our fingers, watching as solar cycle 24 ramps up. What are we going to do if we get a X-class flare with all of the electronics that we have, that we are depend our lives depend on every single day? The last time that we had a major X-class flare was sometime in 2004. Back then, most everybody had cell phones, but we didn't rely on electronic goods as much as we do now to stay connected. Heck, Facebook and cell phones and texting and transfers of data, blazingly fast speeds, and I still find myself tapping my foot going, come on, hurry up. So bigger, better, faster, more, but it could all come to a screeching halt with an X-class flare at the right time facing Earth. Some of these flares, like the one back in 1859, are so powerful and so dead on facing Earth that they only take about 18 hours to get from the sun to Earth. 18 hours to travel 93 million miles, and that's particles, not light. So these things are really, really energized, and they can cause a geomagnetic storm, which doesn't mean a whole lot when you're talking about Morse code tapped out with voltage over a wire that's 2,000 miles long. But it means a lot when you got that $500 iPod in your pocket. So just want you to not put all your eggs in one basket. Make sure you've got your cash out of the bank. Keep what you need in the bank to work with. But you might want to stay liquid for the next few years as we make our way through this solar cycle. You wouldn't want your account to suddenly hit Control-Alt-Delete by itself. In the news, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, 2,000 people showed up to the food bank only to find 375 boxes of food. If they had been listening to this program and known about 1-800-PREPARE.com, they would have had some food stored for hard times and been able to keep their burden off the emergency services. You are fortunate that we do this research for you. Go to 1-800-PREPARE.com and place your order at your first opportunity. And when you do, put in the code word Brooks, and you will get an additional 10% off. Not only do they have fantastic prices, blazingly fast shipping, and the right stuff. You don't have to go and wonder what to buy. It's all figured out for you. It's all made in kit form. It all will last up to 25 years without refrigeration or special treatment. It's lightweight. You can pack it with you, and you'll be prepared. You won't be one of the 1,700 that showed up when they're out of food. Congress passed a moratorium on funds. That means they denied any further funds for all for-profit small business, except through the grant and loan guarantee programs already established. In contradiction to Saturday's address to the nation, where Obama said he was going to create 300,000 jobs in the next 12 months by investing money in small business. If you are a small business that has not received a grant already prior to 2009, then you are not eligible for grants any longer. This is interesting, very interesting, since Obama again yesterday used the name of small business in vain to bolster his sagging numbers. Good news from the publisher. Finally, remembering the future of the physics of the soul and time travel is through the editing and heading for production. The news came in Friday. Boy, were we happy to hear it. We hope to see the first copy in a couple of weeks and then off to the presses. So those of you that have purchased the ebook are going to get 25% off on the printed version of the book. And the printed version of the book has gone through significant edits since you received your ebook. That's why we really appreciate you being part of it. That $7.95 that you spent on the ebook isn't lost. You're going to get a discount on the printed version, and you're going to get the audiobook when it comes out for free. So you did a really good thing, and you helped us out, and we're going to repay you by making sure you have value added to that. And don't forget, Twitter is alive and well on X Squared Radio. We have quite a few followers. The text, and you can follow it at xsquaredradio.com. Come on, sign up and follow us. I add stuff all day as we approach the announcement of the Inner Earth Expedition and the launch of the first affordable electric vehicles in the nation and other great things. So you can follow me on Twitter by just searching for Brooks Agnew. You can find it. And also Vision Motor Cars has a Twitter as well if you want to look that one up. And don't forget to click on the Web Talk Radio link at X Squared Radio. This is a short 30-minute version of the program. The more you click and the more your friends go there, the better our chances are of syndication. That means we get to play on the airwaves. So let's spread the word. We need something positive out there to go on. And we'll be back in about 40 seconds, so don't go away. Hang in there. Later on tonight, on X Squared Radio, we have the author of Science Was Wrong, Stanton Friedman, my good friend. We've met in person out there on the speaking tour and have known each other for a few years, traded emails and phone conversations. Excellent, excellent lecturer and writer. He's been on Larry King Live. He is a physicist with a lot of presence in this genre, and we appreciate him. So hopefully he'll be on with us at the 6 o'clock hour, and we'll make our way through the first hour with just you. The phone lines are open, 415-762-1161. Hey, there's a lot happening out there. I mean, a lot happening out there in new energy. A lot of breakthroughs have been made, of course, over the last few years, but now some of them because of several things. The high cost of oil, the BP oil spill, some of the controversy over who got the money and how much money was it, and oh my goodness, are we still dependent on oil? All that fever and rhetoric that surrounds that has really fed a lot of great energy ideas forward. Now, we hate to see the catastrophes, the disasters, especially the financial ones in this business. But we do like to see the new energy ideas coming forth. There are all kinds of companies out there that are doing a very good job in retrofitting things we already drive. We already have a lot of wind generators out there, and I've heard some positive and some negative about it. I had a woman just a couple of weeks ago, unsolicited, make this comment that she said she thought the windmills were just so ugly, and she wished they would go away. And I was really nice about it. Come on. I said, come on. You got these wonderful generators out there. Some of them putting out 2 megawatts for a freestanding unit. They turn about 15 and a half RPM. And the electricity is free and it's clean. And as long as they're up there in the mountains, not, you know, in subdivisions or where driving ranges, although I think that would be just fascinating to see if it could hit the propellers at a driving range. Not that it's fun to go to the driving range when the winds are high, which are when these wind generators really do better. But when you think about it, all that electricity just free for the taking, and these companies that have taken the risk to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to not only design these things, but then put them in place, take the risk, and take their payback, just like you would if you put one in your backyard, over a number of years. It's a great thing. It's a great thing for America. It's a great thing for the planet. And at least as far as I'm concerned, it's hopeful that we're learning to live within the energy bounds of our environment. We're not so intent on just shoveling it into our gas tank and stepping on the gas. Actually, you haven't stepped on the gas in a long time. You step on the air, but it's not as sexy to say, step on the air, man. But that's what you're doing. You're just increasing the airflow through the fuel injection system. And the fuel injection system responds to that differential pressure and then dumps fuel into your engine to match it, keep that stoichiometry right. And that's how it works, folks. So you haven't stepped on the gas in a long time. You could call it the throttle. You could call it the accelerator, but not the gas pedal. That doesn't apply anymore. Anyway, we also have solar cell breakthroughs that are just phenomenal. We have flexible cells, thin film solar technology. Not very efficient. It takes a few acres of those puppies to generate any serious electricity. But there are some high-density crystal solar cells, like SBM Solar out of North Carolina, and Sunlight out of Ohio. A couple of them have the crystal solar panels, which are much more efficient. And they're getting the cost down. It's still pretty expensive. Some of the units are still $4 a watt. But the cost is coming down a couple dollars a watt, and maybe it'll get down below a couple dollars a watt. And, you know, for a home, it's a little bit of a payback, guys, especially if you're going to stay with 120-volt circuits in your house. If you're going to switch everything over to DC, get down to low voltage, you have a much better chance of going off-grid, at least with your lighting and your wall plugs. If you still insist on having air conditioning or heat pumps that require, you know, 40 amps at 220 volts, then I'm afraid you're still stuck being on the grid. But if you can live with swamp coolers, which are basically just a fan blowing through filters that are coated with a thin film of water that trickles over them, in the drier climates like New Mexico and Arizona, Nevada, Idaho, the swamp coolers work just fine because you got very low humidity to work with. And in the summertime, they can put out 55 degree air and make your house a lot more comfortable to live in, keep your piano from cracking and all that kind of stuff. But out here in the east, where the humidity often hovers above 90% most of the summer, swamp coolers won't do much good at all. There's just no room in the air for more water. So you have to use a heat pump. You have to use something that's driven by some sort of freon to do the heat exchange between the inside and outside of the house. And that's going to require a compressor, and that's going to require some horsepower. So if you need to have that kind of environmental control, you're going to be on the grid for a while. Unless you can afford a couple of rooftops full of solar cells, then you can probably go differently. There are, however, some energy-efficient devices that are coming along. Some of them are beginning to make their way out of the garage. I got to tell you this. Since it's just you and me here on the radio, I was having a personal conversation face-to-face with Congressman Larry Kissel a week ago this last Friday. And we were talking, of course, about grants and small business. I had made the comment that, you know, when a company checks that little box that says small business, you should move their name to the top of the priority list. And when a company has filed bankruptcy or has had to have bailout funds of some kind, you need to move their name to the bottom of the list. And he leaned over to me and said, there's a reason why these guys are still working out of their garage. Yeah, I know. You feel it too. Edison's rolling over in his grave, and I'm sure that Bill Gates would give him a slap on the back of the head. But that's the truth, and, you know, the comment rolled out so smoothly and so naturally that I was convinced it was the hallway mantra in Washington. And while the Washington parties are fighting over each other like dogs over a media pork chop, trying to figure out who's going to give money to Americans who have exhausted their unemployment benefits, while denying funds to the very small business that would put those Americans back to work, it really boggles the mind. It makes you wonder about that old adage, a mind is a terrible thing. Yeah. by the way, if you've just joined us, at the top of the hour, 6 p.m. Pacific, we are going to try to get Stanton Friedman to come on with us. He's the author of Science Was Wrong. It's his latest in a long series of very well-written books on a variety of paranormal science subjects. We're not talking about ghosts and goblins here. We're talking about science at the leading edge, science on the fringe, science with lots and lots of direct observation and not much real explanation. Stanton Friedman has been on the front lines of that for many decades. He's been on Larry King Live. He's been on Fox News. I have met him myself out in on the lecture circuit. Fine individual, and we're looking forward to having him on the program tonight. Our phone lines are open, 415-762-1161, anywhere on planet or off planet. If you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us, 415-762-1161. Just this hour, we're talking about news of the day in science, because this is primarily scientific talk radio for your mind, if you haven't lost it already. We can help you with that here. Just tune in and get your friends to tune in, because we cover not the leading edge of science. We're out in the air that's being pushed by the leading edge of science, so you can tell what's coming. Astronomers have discovered a new star. Yeah, like that's real news. No, really it is. Astronomers have discovered a new star even larger than our sun. Well, that's not really striking either, except that this massive star is a colossal 265 times larger and millions of times brighter than the sun, making it the largest star on record. The sheer mass of the star has astonished scientists, who believed it was impossible for a star to be more than 150 times larger than the sun. Again, mainstream science takes a giant step backward into the annals of fables. What they once thought was irrefutable and impossible has now been discovered. So, recent history books are being rewritten. High priests of science are being scolded, and they're expanding the limits of reality. The star, known as R136A1, there will be a test later, so you'll want to write that down. R136A1 was discovered in a region of space known as the Tarantula Nebula region by a team of astronomers. The team, led by astrophysicist Paul Crowther of Sheffield University, used an instrument simply known as the Very Large Telescope. Yes, there's an acronym for it, the VTL, based in the Atacama Desert of North Chile, to study the cluster of stars in which R136A1 is based. as well as the archival material from the Hubble Space Telescope. The team discovered two clusters of young stars, NGC 3603 and RMC 136A. Within these clusters, the astronomers discovered a clutch of monster stars, including stars that are several million times brighter and 10 times larger than the Sun. The sheer mass of these newly discovered stars, in comparison with our Sun, is due to the star's relative age. Unlike humans, stars are born heavy and then lose weight as they age. Being a little over a million years old, the most extreme star they've ever seen, R136A1, is already middle-aged and has undergone an intense weight loss program, shedding a fifth of its initial mass over that time, or more than 50 solar masses. Lightweight stars such as our Sun tend to live a long and quiet life. Heavyweight stars, however, such as R136A1 and others discovered by the astronomers, tend to live fast and die young, as it were, living an intense but short existence before exploding as a supernova. Such heavyweight stars are far less common than their lightweight counterparts. Owing to the rarity of these monsters, it could be unlikely that this new record will be broken anytime soon, at least from our perspective. By the way, most large stars, or stars that are at least four times the size of our Sun, when they lose that explosive ability they call fusion, it's the reason why you can go out to the beach and still get brown, and the reason plants still grow on our planet on the surface, is because that explosive power is still there. But when they lose that ability, gravity takes over. And that supernova event is actually triggered when all of the electrons around all of those now helium molecule atoms, those electrons get sucked down onto the protons, and bingo, you have a plus one and a minus one. Add those together, and what do you get? You get the current Congress. No, you get a neutron. That's right, neutral charge. At first it happens slowly, and then a little more suddenly, and then massively all at once. And that concussion is called a supernova. It cleaves off the atmosphere of that Sun, consumes everything within the blast range of the star, converting whatever it runs into pure energy. And hopefully we don't get to witness that anytime soon. We don't like stars to go supernova anywhere close to our neighborhood. Far away as possible, and we want to look at it years after it happened. But this star, it could have already occurred, and we won't know about it until the next Super Bowl, or the one after. So a lot is going on the Sun. And the interesting thing is, and I'm not really sure if it's because of the sophistication and the population of instruments with which we watch the Sun. You know, we've got SOHO up there. Now we've got the Solar Dynamics Observatory. And we have lots and lots of Earth-based observation posts that are watching the Sun, as long as it's up, of course, and reporting back on what's going on and not going on up there. The Sun's been very predictable for the last 200 years. Regularly going through its solar cycles, some of them a little more intense than others. But recently we've undergone a very long, record-breaking minimum, and we're not really sure if the Sun is just sort of storing up for a very short ramp-up to full maximum in solar cycle 24, and then all hell is going to break loose, or if it's just going to be a very long and uneventful solar cycle. We're just not sure. And it's not because we're looking at it more intensely, or maybe it is because of that pesky observation effect. You know, the moon wouldn't exist unless a mouse looked at it. But more than likely, it is galactic forces that are causing the difference in our Sun being the largest gravitational body in our solar system, obviously. The rest of our planets revolve around it and are tethered by it in the middle of blackness of space. It would be the body most sensitive to any changes in galactic gravity, which is exactly what the Mayans predicted would happen. According to Jose Arguelles, who was first exposed to Pakal's tomb lid in 1958 and since then has literally fathered a movement of all kinds of esoteric and scientific disciplines that are studying the amazing 2012 phenomena. On the tomb lid of Pakal was a diagram of how the Earth and the solar system would line up with the rift in the Milky Way. That rift is supposed to represent a very intense gravitational body in the center of our galaxy, which we affectionately call a black hole. Nobody's actually ever seen a black hole, but we've never detected one directly. But mathematically, theoretically, at least in Einsteinian physics, they exist. There are some proponents of what's called brain theory, that's short for membrane. It's sort of an extension of superstring theory, except it's added the idea that two universes collided and created the Big Bang instead of an actual Big Bang occurring from a singularity. It's a competing idea, but it doesn't have a lot of followers in that church yet, so we don't really know for sure, but it is intriguing, and it is interesting, at least to me. And if it's interesting to me, then we're going to talk about it on this program, and hopefully you won't be so looking like a deer caught in the headlights when Morgan Freeman talks about it on Through the Wormhole on Science Channel. You'll be a little educated. You'll be learnt and know what's going on. So the idea that the gravity or gravitational waves coming out of the center of the galaxy could be following this rift in the Milky Way, sort of like a bowling ball that's gone through a bunch of pins. These gravitational waves have kind of cleared away all of the visible matter in this band of the center of the galaxy. And we're getting ready to line up with that. We're getting ready, and we are already passing through charged particles, highly energized particles, different winds, and that what I mean by winds, as opposed to the solar wind, we are now being exposed to a galactic wind that is extending and stretching out our solar wind, like dragging a spot of paint across the floor with a squeegee. That's exactly what the galactic wind is doing to us right now. Sorry, I had to kind of look out the window because we've got a lightning storm outside, and this program has been hit by lightning at least once before. Coincidentally, it was when Jose Arguelles was on the program. Lightning struck the building, knocked out the internet, and Jose Arguelles kept on talking as though I was still here. And after we got everything rebooted and back on and hooked up and came back on, I said, wow, we just got struck by lightning, and that was very auspicious considering what we were talking about at the time. So hopefully that doesn't happen again today because I'm talking about the same subject, but it is rather energetic outside the window, shall we say. So, and my AccuWindow forecast is pretty accurate, folks, so keep in mind that we could go off the air any second due to a loud noise and a flash of light, one of which you will detect over this microphone. What is happening now is that the planet Earth and all of life on the Earth, all the molecules that are on the Earth that make up the mass, that make up your body, every time you go out to eat, or you go shopping and you bring something in and put it in your refrigerator, prepare it and consume it, you are eating the mass of the Earth. It came from the dirt one way or another, whether you're eating the fish of the sea or the plants of the ground or the hoofed or winged animals of our planet. you are consuming the mass of Earth. And that mass of Earth has been bathed in this kind of energy before, long before your physical body existed on this Earth. And you are now entangled with the Earth, especially if you're eating locally. What do I mean by eating locally? I mean, you're not living in Oklahoma eating cabbage that was grown in Southern California. The things that you are eating come from the region in which you live. It's sort of important because the antigens, toxins, energies, the frequencies and energies that might be harmful to your body that you're being exposed to living in the place that you're living, whether they're power lines or gravity or air pollutants or water pollutants, or whether they're pollens or allergies in your area. If you consume food that has been grown in your area, you stand a much better chance of being able to fight off those toxins. In fact, one of the guests we've had in this program, Landon Shurashkin, who is the spokesperson for the Anastasia series, he got his PhD in forestry. I met him before he'd finished his PhD, and then we've had him on this program since he's accomplished that. And a very credible botanist and sociologist, and I think it was really amazing that he mentioned in Russia there are individuals who have been taught through this Anastasia phenomenon that when they go to plant their garden, which, by the way, 60% of all fresh produce in Russia is produced in home gardens, not in supermarkets, the seeds that they plant in the garden are first placed in the mouth of the person who is going to consume the food. And the seed soaks up the saliva and thus some of the DNA of the person that's going to consume the food coming from that seed. That seed is then planted in the ground. It grows, incorporated with some of the saliva and DNA that it received from the planter. And when the food comes to fruition and is consumed, the theory is that that food will contain some of the nutrients, some of the minerals, some of the qualities that the person who prepared the seed for planting needs. So things like liver disease, kidney disease, diabetes, those kinds of things can be more effectively treated through diet when the food consumed was planted, prepared in that manner, and planted by the person who's going to consume it. Made a tremendous amount of sense to me when we had him on the program, and I just can't wait to get a piece of dirt of my own and try it. But that being said, we have made great efforts at buying fruits and vegetables from local markets, not so much hauled in from Venezuela or from Florida, but grown within the same ecosystem where I am residing, wherever that happens to be. So that means if I move around a lot, my diet's going to change. And that also means, I'm not going to go down to the fast food restaurant and consume grade B beef that has been prepared in another state in a completely different ecosystem and then handled in a factory to produce the same taste in Tokyo as it's going to produce in L.A., as it's going to produce in St. Louis, Charlotte, or Louisville, or Houston. So those are methods of advice, methodologies of advice that we would like to pass forward to you. And if you're a regular listener to X Squared Radio, then you heard the Leonid Shurashkin interview. And if you are not, I implore you to go back to xsquaredradio.com, click on the archives, and subscribe, and go back and listen to that fine program. Because there's a lot of great stuff out there in the archives. And when we talk about stuff like this, we talk about the Earth lining up with this galactic center in 2012, people often want to know, gee, what do I do? How do I get prepared? What does it really mean? Whose book do I read? Am I supposed to meditate? Am I Am I supposed to lean through my legs and kiss my butt goodbye? Should I make friends with someone who has a bunker? You know, all those questions we get all the time. And the reality is probably way different than what everybody is saying. But I have had people say, you know, 2013, you guys are all going to be eating crow because nothing is going to happen. Well, I got to tell you, wake up and smell the coffee, my friends, because the things are already happening. We are already seeing the effects of it. If you were out today or have been out this summer or were out this last winter when all cold records were broken all over the planet, now hot records are being broken all over the planet. The Antarctic is growing. The Arctic is shrinking. The salinity of the ocean is changing. The carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are changing. The ecosystem is changing by the week because of the biological systems that are going extinct and others are blooming. The Earth is changing right before our eyes. It's not going to be December 20th, 2012, everything's fine, and December 21st, all hell breaks loose, and we can party like it's 1999. Come on. We're ramping up to it. We're ramping up to it. For 27 years now, we have been seeing an increase in earthquakes, not just the frequency, but also the intensity. You know, there were 25 earthquakes in the last 24 hours, and four of them were over 5.0, and one in Tonga was over 6.0. By the way, this in Tonga will be the resting and feeding grounds of the humpback whale for the next few months. So we hope this area stays serene while they are there, at least. We don't like to see earthquakes out in the ocean, not 6.0. Because when the earth rumbles at sea, we call it the sea floor. And if it rumbles close to the surface and not 75 or 80 kilometers deep, then it tends to cause tsunamis. And these islands are at particular risk with tsunamis that get up in the 40 and 50 foot range. And if it's pointed at a continent and you get these subsonic waves, you could be looking at a tsunami much higher than that in the 500 to 600 foot range. This is not what we want to see if you're living in Tampa or if you're living in Miami. Not when the highest point in the state is probably 10 feet above sea level. So all you need to do is look around, my friends, and you will see that the effects of where we are in the galaxy are already being felt. This is not alarmism. It's just go to the window and look out a little bit. Listen to programs like X Squared Radio, and you will see that there is a difference between July 2010 and July 1980. And there will be a difference, and it will increase in intensity and frequency in July 2011 and in July 2012. You don't want to be like the folks, the 2,000 people in Tulsa, Oklahoma, who went to the food bank and found 375 boxes of food. You have time. You are empowered to do something about it. You have knowledge of the future that we are giving you right here. And you have, I was going to say you have the responsibility to do something about it, but you know what? You don't. If you want to do more than survive, then you now have the information to do so. If you want to be walking around in a pair of loafers and slacks for the next couple of years, with no job, no water, no food, nothing stored, no preparedness whatsoever, when you have plenty of time to do so, that is your choice. You can be responsible either way, and that's fine. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so the choices you are making right now, today, in 2010, will determine how you weather 2012. Now, am I saying you need to go out and buy $10,000 worth of food storage, a bunch of guns, and a bunker and sit in your backyard? No, I'm not. I'm telling you that the planet is going to go through some allergic reactions here. There have never been 7 billion conscious souls living on the earth at one time. So the chances of some contagion, that is a sociological sudden event that's caused by people panicking and spreading the panic one to another, hence the name contagion. The contagion of concentrated groups of society breaking down, not unlike Katrina in 2005 when you had millions of people hit the highway and literally going through an entire tank of gas before they could get out of sight of the skyscrapers of Louisiana. That is a lack of preparation, my friends. But this storm isn't coming on us like Katrina. It's not one where you only had 4 or 5 days' notice. You have a couple of years' notice, and we already see the storm surge. We already see the high winds. We already see the intense temperatures, the rarity of clean water. We already see the stress on the debt structure of the nation and also the debt structure of the individuals. We have been telling you for years, keep a bulk of your cash out of the bank. Leave enough in there to, you know, make your bills, your light bill, and the normal things like that. But don't store large amounts of cash in your checking account. This is foolish. You need to have that money in your hands. And you need to be able to convert it into hard goods quickly. And I'm just telling you, hundreds and thousands of banks are going insolvent. That means that if your money's in the bank, it's not coming out. And I can tell you right now, the small print in the FDIC means you'll get your principal back as long as it's under $100,000, and they have years to get it to you. Years to get it to you. You will not be able to walk to the bank and say, I have $99,000 in the bank and I want it today. Sorry, folks, you'll be given a rain check, and when they put the thing back together and they get some kind of bank to come in and buy that paper, then and only then will you see your principal back and all your interest is gone. And you would have had it. You would have had it in your hands if you just would have followed what we told you to do here on X Squared Radio and keep the bulk of your cash in your hands in some kind of form that's transferable, whether it's cash, diamonds, gold, food, water, not land, not a Ferrari, no, not a Mercedes-Benz, not Gucci shoes or handbags. Nothing like that. I'm talking currency of some kind, okay? And food will definitely be a currency. So there's a lot going on out there. We want you to pay attention. So that's why we bring you this information here. So that we're not alarmist. So that we're preparatory. We're helping you prepare. And if you didn't listen to the very first of the program, our friends at 1-800-PREPARE.com have the stuff for you. 1-800-PREPARE.com. Don't waste your time going down to Walmart and buying emergency preparedness supplies, okay? That stuff's not going to last. It's not packaged correctly. You can't carry it with you. It's not dehydrated. It won't last 25 years in its existing packaging. The stuff you want is sold at 1-800-PREPARE.com. Now, there's more. If you go there to their website and you order, you are going to get 10% off because you're going to remember to put in the word Brooks in the code, in the gift code box. You put that in, you get another 10% off. You're not paying tax anyway. And believe me, it won't be long before you will start paying tax on those purchases. So make your purchase dollar go further. Save your gas. Don't drive out there and waste a bunch of gas driving here, driving there, trying to put it all together, okay? It can be done with just one click. You have a PC and a credit card in your hands, so you can be prepared in a matter of minutes by going there and getting the right stuff and get prepared. Now, this next hour, we're going to try to have Stanton Friedman on. He's the author of Science Was Wrong. I don't know if you've read a book by Stanton Friedman or not. He is a physicist, very popular lecturer, been on Larry King Live all around the world. I've met him at one speaking venue, and I've heard him several times. This book is about startling truths about cures, theories, and inventions they declared impossible. In fact, he has a new word he has coined in this book called the Impossibilists. And we'll talk a little bit about that tonight with Stan. 1 hour, maybe two, if we can get him to stay. And we'll keep trying him, and hopefully we have him on at the top of the hour. It is about a quarter till the hour. Our phone lines are open, 415-762-1161. Any news events out there on the BP oil spill? Oh, I should say not spill anymore. It's been capped, right? Yeah, yeah, everything's under control. Pay attention to the television screen, and please don't look behind the curtain, okay? Because if you look behind the curtain, you're going to see that they've been faking television. I know it's hard to believe. Gosh, television's so real. I mean, you got to believe it because you can see it, right? It's true. BP has been faking its command center television feeds. Why? I have no idea. This at a time when they're trying to build credibility, you would think. Nothing really instilling a lot of confidence in me that everything is under control. That being said, last week on the program, we had Dr. Tom Tismato on the program. He is a board-certified physician. And after the program, about 5 or 6 hours after the program, he sent me a very interesting paper. As it turns out, this deep oil that has been drilled up out of the depths beneath the Gulf of Mexico has some very peculiar properties. One of those properties is one we really didn't want to see. The oil is radioactive. Yeah, I don't have any more information than that for you, because the instruments that were used to measure the oil are Geiger-Müller instruments. Now, that means that any scintillation, any gamma decay, is going to create an electronic event inside the Geiger-Müller detector and is going to make a tick like you hear on a Geiger counter. And that's where the word comes from. Mr. Geiger is the guy that invented it. A single wire or two that goes through this detector picks up that electronic signal. It is multiplied many times by a MOSFET circuit so that it can be detected more clearly. And then it makes a tick on the needle. So according to what measurements have been made, the radiation is somewhere in the neighborhood of 500. Now, the units aren't really important because you're not really going to know what I'm talking about. But relatively speaking, here's what we're talking about. Normal background radiation for someone who's going to live 100 years without any ill effects is 30. This is 500. This would be grounds for a toxic waste cleanup for a Superfund site if 500 were found on the ground at an oil site, which it has been in Marshall, Tennessee. You would see the earth being dug up with bulldozers, taken to hills covered with black plastic where they could be left to decay for roughly 10,000 years. Some of the half-lives of these nuclides, like thorium and sodium-40, are way up there. Some are very short-lived, like radon. Those of you that are listening to this program know what radon is. You've heard about it on television public service announcements, but you may not know where it comes from. It is a daughter of uranium. So what appears to be happening is these deep oil wells, 16,000-17,000 feet below the ocean floor, are getting close to deposits of uranium, which are deep under the earth. That uranium is decaying, as it will do if you put it on the counter in front of you. Except if you put it on the counter in front of you, you're going to end up with cancer in a very short amount of time because the gamma radiation is going to go into your body. It's going to activate the neutrons inside your body. And then you're going to have an alpha decay, which is going to destroy tissue in your body and cause abnormalities in the duplication of DNA, hence cancer. Now, that 500 is coming out. It's being processed at refineries. It's being catalyzed and cracked and distilled in various manners and put into your gas tank and burned. I don't know. I just don't know if the radiation continues forward through the subsequent chemical processes. What I do know is that the individuals that handle it, the groundwater that's being affected by it, these tar balls and slicks that have drifted into marshlands in Louisiana, Alabama, and tar balls being picked up in Florida and hauled to the waste, the landfills, they are radioactive. Now, it would be very, very nice to have some spectrographic data on these to know what species we're talking about, what kind of nuclide data, but we don't have that information yet. I would highly recommend, somebody taking a spectrometer out there, and they make some nice handheld ones for about $750. The Identifinder is my favorite. It's rugged, waterproof. They make them, they will even go underwater. They're sensitive, and they'll be able to take the data and tell you what that radiation is. It's important to know what that radiation is because those five states are being exposed to it. Hang on a second. We got a little technical difficulty. I'm handling it right now with the producer. While those of you are with us on the recording, you're not seeing what's going on the screen, and I am. For some reason, talking about this on the radio has just caused my sampling rate to drop from 24 kilohertz to 12 kilohertz. So we're trying to find out what I need to do about it. And who in the world would have dropped my sample rate? Very interesting. Well, okay, so we're talking about forbidden subjects, and we're at the top of the hour. So let's go ahead and take a quick break. We will jump off the air, jump back on, and see if we can get a better signal. Okay? And we'll be right back after these messages. Don't go away.
Body isn't feeling too well these days, you're gonna start taking this hemp. I say go to hempusa.org. You may not like what I'm about to say, but you know I'm gonna say it anyway. The government doesn't want the best for you. They keep you down, they keep you blue, they starve your body for all its nutrients. They won't let you grow industrial hemp. It really doesn't make any kind of sense when it's so healthy for the world and useful for you, my friends. I hope Mr. Bush will hear this song, for the heart of America wants this one. Go to hempusa.org. If you're a truther, an anarchist, or renegade, you only want things that God has made. Go to hempusa.org. We offer free shipping anywhere in the States. Go to hempusa.org.
BBSRadio.com. not mainstream. It could be here. Information and knowledge bringing humanity closer to truth. BBSRadio.com.
Glad you're back with us here at X Squared Radio. We're listening to a little Tchaikovsky, Hymn of the Cherubim, music, universal language. You don't have to be able to speak Russian to know this is beautiful stuff. And we're glad you're here with us live on X Squared Radio. It's the July 25th, 2010. If you want to join the program tonight, you can reach us anytime. On planet, off planet, if you can reach us, reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us, 415-762-1161, 415-762-1161, hour two of X Squared Radio. We're trying to get Stanton Friedman on right now. He's the author of Science Was Wrong. Excellent, excellent book, highly recommend it. Stanton is a good writer, for all ages. And, if we can get him to come on this hour, we will. If we can't, then we'll just split the time between you and me, and we'll talk about the events of the day, and we'll try again in the third hour to get Stanton to come on the program. Sometimes schedules get a little busy. People get wound up doing the things of summer, and they just let things go. But that's okay. We're always here. Sometimes we have to run an archive because we're traveling. And speaking of travel, if you're listening to X Squared Radio and you've ever wanted to go to Egypt, and I don't mean just go with an ordinary tour group. I don't mean just arriving on an airplane and with a camera and say, "Oh, honey, let's go see what we can see in Egypt." We have put together something special for you, a mystery school. I'm hosting it. John Riley of Zero Point Research is co-hosting it. And this is a small group of very special opportunities. We're not going to be going the ordinary way. No, no. We're going back a few thousand years, and we're going to be sailing the Nile. So if you want to come with us, you can contact me on Facebook at Brooks Agnew. Or at X2-Radio, or you can send me an email by contacting me at bagnew@x2-radio.com, or you can call me. My number is posted on the website at x2radio.com. It's posted at the Facebook at Brooks Agnew or X2-Radio, or believe me, you can find out how to contact me. I don't want to put a blanket call out there because There are only 15 seats. That's it. This is a small group, and we are going off the beaten path. We're going to cities that have not been visited by the West ever. Hidden cities, hidden technologies that have been prophesied to come forth now. Who is going to bring them forth? Who is going to witness this? Depends on you. If you want to find out more about it, you can contact me on Facebook, write me an email, I'll be happy to send it to you. There's only 15 spots. We're just now making the announcement, so these will probably fill up in about a week. If you ever, ever thought about going to Egypt and you want to make it special, and what I mean by special, how about private time in the king's chamber of the pyramids? How about the ability to see ruins that have not been walked by tourists ever? How about areas that are just now being excavated that have been buried for 5,000 years? You'll be the first Westerner to see it. If you know anything about the books that I've written, the Ark of Millions of Years series, or this new one that's coming out, Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, you know, we get into places nobody else gets into. We see things that no one else gets to see. Why? Because they've been saved. Or maybe it was us that built them in the first place. So if you want to participate in that, believe me, the financial energy will make itself known if you're the one called to do it. Don't forget, Twitter is alive and well on X Squared Radio. You go to xsquaredradio.com. You'll see it right on the right-hand side. You can all see the things that we add all day, different kinds of announcements. We talk about the Inner Earth Expedition coming up. We talk about the launch of the nation's first affordable electric vehicles and other great things. We would love to have you following us, so join us on Twitter. And by the way, if you visit xsquaredradio.com, you will notice right at the top that there's a share button, an add share button. It looks a little bit like a bunch of little Facebook, Twitter, blah, blah, blah buttons all stacked together right there in the middle. Click on that and share the website somewhere. Help spread it, because if you'll go to Web Talk Radio, the Web Talk Radio link at X Squared Radio, you're gonna see something that you haven't seen before. For the last 5 years, we have and still are a proud member of the BBS Radio Network. This is, for all intents and purposes, the largest, most clicked on, most widely listened to internet radio network in the nation, probably in North America, and maybe even in the world. And we've been happy to be here, and we will always be here. This Web Talk Radio is a venture into broadcast. This means it's not internet. It is now, but it is a syndicated run, which means in 16 weeks, the content that we put on this program, on this site, is going to be launched on a terrestrial radio network. That is to say, over the airwaves. People will be listening to it while driving in their cars or sitting at their house with their stereo on. And we're going to expand this message that we have been discussing with you for the last 5 years. You, the listener, have told us this is what you want. You want scientific talk radio. You want the leading edge, cutting edge, absolute understanding of what's going on around us, what has gone on, what is going on now, and what will go on. You trust us to bring that information to you. You realize that this is not a full-time job for me. This is not my living. None of us here make a living at this. This is not a do-or-die thing where we have to entertain you in order to keep our popularity. We realize that you're kind of tired of that. You have options out there like that. You can sit back and be entertained. But you can't always sit back and be informed. and trust what you're being informed with. So our first broadcast on X Squared Radio was in September of 2005, and now we're coming up on September 2010. So it's been a long road, and there are hundreds and hundreds of hours of archives stored at X Squared Radio and also stored at BBS Radio. Either one of the archives is acceptable to us because you are supporting the infrastructure it takes to keep this message coming to you. You can listen always live for free, but you can't always get away, as is evident today, 5 p.m. Pacific time. Many people were still out enjoying the blazingly awesome weather. So in the wintertime, you know, we get a little higher audience because people come in because it's foggy or rainy. Hey, let's go listen to X Squared Radio. And for now, we're not on that car radio that you're driving around, but we will be soon if you go to Web Talk Radio and click on that site and convince our sponsors that you want to hear this content. Now, we have only been on the program for 8 weeks, and we have already broken all records going back 29 years. 29 years in broadcast radio, they have never, ever had a radio program come on and in 8 weeks jump up to the top three radio programs in the queue. That's right. And guess what we haven't done yet? We haven't done any promotion. It's only you, the X Squared Radio and BBS Radio listener, that has got us to that point. We haven't even branched out into the listener market yet. When we do, you will be carried along with us. And we will take this message forward to millions, tens of millions of people. And hopefully, it will be just in time. As we carry forward this hour, I want to make sure you know the phone lines are open, 415-762-1161, hour two of X Squared Radio, July 25th, 2010. You know, when I was young, and if you'll go to the website, rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com, this is my newest book. It's just now out of editing. It's heading for production now. I should get the galley copy by the end of the month. First of next month, and then it is immediately going to press, if they haven't made too many mistakes in it. And then it's going to go out there and start changing the world. This book was the culmination of an event that happened back at James Gilliland's ranch in the summer of 2006. And it also were the results that got me going into radio. Because it's kind of been a hobby of mine, off and on, sometimes during my life. But I'm a commercial scientist and an engineer. We build electric vehicles. We build biodiesel plants. We work 12 hours a day, 7 days a week to make things happen. We build things and clean things up and figure out more efficient ways of doing things. Radio has always been kind of a hobby to me. But with our success on BBS Radio the last 5 years, it is really made a difference in my life, in your life, and in the tone and the awareness of what's going on out there in the world. And that's important to me. Every time I think about turning the microphone off for good and going back to the calculator and the computer to build things, I think about you sitting out there at your workstation working on your favorite project, working on Maps or AutoCAD or English papers or whatever you're working on while listening to X Squared Radio. I see you sitting there. I hear your energy while you're listening to this program, even though you've never called in. And I wonder what it is you wonder about, what you hear on the news. And sometimes you might hear some extraordinary scientific breakthrough and realize that very soon you're going to hear about it on X Squared Radio, and you're going to hear what it really means. You're going to hear the truth behind it. And when we have a guest on who has been on many other radio programs and television programs, and he says something, reveals something that he has said many, many times before. I guarantee you, no broadcaster ever, ever came back to them and said, now wait a minute, let me see if I get this straight. And we go into the physics, or we go into the chemistry, we go into the electrical engineering, the mechanical engineering, logistics, mathematics. You are going to hear the results of that counterpoint. You get that right here on X Squared Radio and nowhere else. It hasn't been on radio in a long time. And that is the kind of inquisition. That is the kind of intelligent conversation that has been missing from radio for a long time. You get a lot of opinion. You get a lot of commentary. You get a lot of news mixed with voice, mixed with passion, mixed with patriotism or various politics. But you don't get the facts. You don't get the mathematics of it. You don't get the physics of it. You don't really explore the limits of what's being talked about on the radio. And whether it's transcendental physics we're talking about, time travel we're talking about, or we're talking about epigenetics, or we're talking about experiments into the paranormal, like past life regressions and looking into the future and reading cosmological tea leaves as to what's going to happen in the future. That's what we do here. And I think that's the audience that we have built. Now, if you want spiritualisms and you want to feel good and you want political rage or you want revenge, then there are plenty of programs out there that will do that for you. But there's only one, where you get the science and the engineering and the comparison and the exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. And that's right here. And that's why we appreciate you being here with us. So if you've had any question, if you've been to a recent conference, you've read a newspaper or an article, you had a professor tell you something, and you have a question, why don't you call in and bring it up tonight? 415-762-1161. 415-762-1161. I don't care what the question's about. If I don't know, I'll tell you I don't know, or I'll flip it to my producer, who's a lot smarter than I am. One way or another, we'll find the answer for you. Or we'll just discuss it. If it's something that you're concerned about in the news that you've heard about the BP oil spill or about space exploration or about time travel or about disease in the 21st century or about socioeconomic forces that are working on the economy, on whether we can actually stand more national debt, what's going to happen to the global money supply and the flow of capital, and by capital I mean the value of our planet. I'm not talking about the money. I'm talking about the value of our planet, not the cash, the real meaningful stuff, the gold, the information, the labor, the goods that we build with our hands and move around our planet. How does that balance out? How does it affect your life? How does 2012 and the idea of it affect you personally? That's what I want to know. 415-762-1161. I'm at a sort of a quandary here between comparing what we see happening sociologically to the planet as we now communicate with each other in ways we've never communicated with each other. You know, it's hard to understand the sociological, the social change that has come to pass on our planet with the internet, with Facebook, with MySpace, with chatting and emails. You know, there have been several different combinations of that over the last, since 1996, when the internet really became viable for the average person through high-speed internet on cable. dial-up, these kinds of things just weren't possible. But now that people can access the internet through their cable TV or even through satellite, these kinds of communications are possible. And if they're possible, then they're going to take place. And whether the boys down at Facebook knew what they were doing or not, what they did is they provided a way for people to candidly speak to one another anywhere on the planet. You allowed people to put a little bit of themselves on Facebook, whether it was a profile shot or whether it was an avatar or whatever, but a little bit of themselves on Facebook just to see if they'd be interesting to another person. And guess what? They were. And they started talking to one another, first across a few campuses, and then a few cities, and then a few states, and then a few nations. And now there are 500 million people communicating with each other just on Facebook alone. 500 million people. This is the web that was prophesied, that was predicted to come forth. Only this web is not one that binds us. It's one that frees us up. It allows us to share our thoughts one with another. This is true communication. This isn't one person sitting at a microphone in Washington and everyone sitting in front of their radio listening to the fireside address. This isn't one person reaching out to the world to try to convince them of one bully message or another. This is communication. These are ideas going back and forth between people, between families, between tribes that have been separated for centuries. Scots and Irish scattered all over the world, now linking up with their roots in ancient Ireland and ancient Scotland. This is the kind of communication that relieves the tension that once ended up as war in our world. If only we could talk things out on a local basis, person to person, family to family, group to group, if only we could talk things out, maybe we wouldn't end up on other sides of the field, charging at one another with our battle axes in hand, not knowing what the hell we're doing there or why we're doing it. We're just doing it. It seems ridiculous to think about, but we have done it. We have done it. Millennia after millennia, we have wiped each other out in violent clashes over misunderstandings, over ideologies, over separations that should never have been. The internet and Facebook and all of these communication methods are changing all of that. We are evolving as a people. We are evolving as a planet. And very, very soon now, my friends, leaders will stand up and call a war and nobody's going to show up. Because long before those tensions get to that point, we, the people, will have discussed it many, many millions and millions of times behind the scenes with shortened little letters like LOL and BTW. We will have shared photographs with each other. We will have shared poetry and we will have shared video. And we would understand what we're about, one person and another. We would learn about each other's foods. We would learn about each other's social mores and family standards. And this kind of activity blends a planet into a people that could be called Earthlings. Now, I know that we look at space exploration, or at least my generation did. The new generation coming up, they don't even know what space exploration is about. I mean, they look in the history books and see a few hundred space shuttle shots, 7 to 12 people at a time going up around the Earth a few times, turning a few wrenches, putting the satellite in place, picking this one up, dropping off a few supplies, changing people out in various space stations, and then heading back to Earth. That's space exploration to them. to us, space exploration was putting men and women in cans and launching them to other planets, letting them step out onto the other planet, kick up a little dust, bring back a few rocks. That was the basics of exploration. By the way, the last time we did that, we were still using vacuum tubes. That's right. We didn't even have such a thing called a computer. It's not to mention a personal computer. There was no such thing as miniaturized electronics then. There was nothing called microwave or 2.4 gigahertz. We didn't have any concept of that in 1969, in 1971 or 72. And when we left two fully operational launch engines on the pad, those of us that were involved in the industry, at least as an enthusiast, opened our palms, stretched our face to the sky, and said, why? Why did we stop? It has been now 41 years since we went to the moon. It's been 38 years since the last time we've been. So, why have we not returned to the moon? Why have we not put our thoughts and our energies together and gone back to the moon and built cities and built tourist places, built labs, built factories, built things that can make use of the hydrogen 3 and the oxygen and water in the soil? A mere 250,000 miles away, a great place to look at Earth. Very stable compared to going around in a titanium can 200 miles above the Earth with all kinds of space trash floating around in orbit and all kinds of meteorites blazing by you at 20,000 miles an hour, waiting to punch a hole in your spacesuit when you're out on an EVA. Much safer to have a roof over your head, don't you think? Much safer to have some kind of electromagnetic deflection device above you to steer any small meteorites away from you as they might be heading for the moon. And who's to say we have to build on the surface of the moon? Why can't we go to the moon and make use of some of the deep caverns that we've found on the moon? That recently we discovered giant-sized volcanic tubes that have long since been dormant and stable on the Earth. Why can't we go down in those and build a safe city inside the moon and work in two locations? Maybe not putting all our eggs in one basket. Maybe making something that's got some kind of gravity close to the Earth that we can work with. You know that the country that controls the moon is going to control the Earth. Why have we not been back to the moon? Why have we not gone back to make more samples, to put more experiments on the moon, to put more equipment on the moon? These are questions that are difficult to ask, and they're difficult to answer. And it's difficult to find people who will tell us the truth. We can talk to people at JPL. We can talk to people at NASA. They don't know. And if they did know, they couldn't say, because of the hierarchy and the way civil service works in our country. You enter the service as an E1 and you work your way up until you become an E9. That's a master chief. Or you work your way from the second lieutenant all the way to general. But on the side of that, there are many more that completely outnumber those in uniform, civil servants that start out in the G range, GS and G. They work their way up to 12s, 14s, 16s, 25s. These are people that make a lifetime, a career of working in things like satellites, defense systems, communications, environmental controls and monitoring. But it's still, everything answers to the president, which is the commander-in-chief. Everything is set up on a military basis and a military schedule and a military need to know. And so you're not going to get the truth from those organizations. It's not in them to do it, because you, the people, have no need to know what we're doing, what we're planning, only and only if it means that some elected official could boost their numbers enough to win against an opponent, then and only then you will be given some of the truth of the information of what is being done out there. I can tell you that if you regularly tune into this program, you're going to hear things like that. Because that's what we do here. We seek after the truth. I will just share with you one press release that recently came out. In fact, it came out just a couple of days ago. Here's the headline. Department of Energy announces $30 million in new small business funding to help commercialize clean energy technologies. That's the headline. Doesn't that sound wonderful? And when you couple that with Obama's address on Saturday of how he was going to help small business and create 300,000 jobs in the next year. It's a start, he said. This is where the backbone of America is. And on and on and on. Let me read the article to you. Let me read the press release to you. U.S. Energy Secretary Stephen Chu announced today that $30 million in funding from the Recovery Act and fiscal year 2010 budget appropriations will be made available to qualified small businesses to support the commercialization of promising new technologies. Today's funding announcement builds on the department's existing efforts under the Small Business Innovation Research Program, that's the SBIR, and the Small Business Technology Transfer Program, the STTR, to develop near-term clean energy technologies and support American small businesses that will play an important role in building the clean energy economy of the future. Pay close attention now. This is the first time the Department of Energy has offered Phase 3 awards under these small business programs. Quote, small businesses are engines of job creation and innovation, and we need their ingenuity and entrepreneurial spirit to drive a clean energy economy, said Secretary Chu. He continues, by helping America's small businesses bring these innovative technologies to market, we will spur economic growth and help reduce the country's energy use. Small companies previously awarded Phase 2 grants through DOE's Small Business Innovation Research Program or Small Business Technology Transfer Program are eligible. Projects that include developed technologies with a strong potential for commercialization and impact on U.S. manufacturing and job creation are encouraged to apply. Successful applicants may receive up to $3 million over 3 years to research, develop, and deploy new technologies. That sounds wonderful. That was a carefully crafted news press release sent out by Secretary Stephen Chu, Energy Secretary of the United States under President Obama. That sounded wonderful, didn't it? Now, after I inquired, here is the response from the Department of Energy. Eligibility for this funding opportunity is for prior Department of Energy grantees which held an SBIR or STTR Phase 1 or Phase 2 grant during the time period of 2005 to 2009. By the way, President Bush was president during those years. Therefore, Mr. Agnew, your firm will not be eligible for this opportunity. In fact, what you really want to pay attention to here is no small business is eligible for this opportunity, except those that were small businesses way back in 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008, up to 2009. If you were a small business back then, and you're still a small business, then and only then you qualify for money from this grant. So, that's what I mean. When you tune into this program, you're going to hear the truth. You're going to hear the details of what's been said inside these grant opportunities. So where it sounds very good on the news, and you drive your car with confidence that new technology is headed your way, and some lucky small business somewhere has $3 more million to use for research to bring that new technology to a near-term fruition here in the United States. Now you know it isn't true. Now you know what they mean by smoke and mirrors. It happens in the energy market too. So while the rhetoric was very nice and very supportive of what promises to be a very challenging midterm election, the reality is nothing was given to small business at all. Again, small business's name was used in vain by the administration to further its own purposes of popularity without actually following through with money. Our phone number tonight, 415-762-1161, 415-762-1161. Any comments, any ideas, any questions out there? You have been exposed to some kind of technological breakthrough on the news, on television, something you've seen on a special or seen in a local trade show in your town, and you have questions about it. You want to know when it's coming, what does it mean? Is it possible to pour water into a car and just drive it around forever? Give us a call. Be happy to talk about it. We'll be happy to discuss the possibilities, because the potential of all potentialities lays at our feet, my friends. The whole world worth of possibilities lays before us. And each one of you affects it. Whether you're thinking of the ideas, whether you work for the person who comes up with the idea, or whether you are a laborer or a factory worker in the factory that makes that idea and makes it available to the public, you're involved. Oh, yeah, I forgot to say, you're also involved if you're a customer. You're also involved if you're an investor. You're also involved if you're a donator to this kind of technology. And whether you want to believe it or not, you're also involved if you do nothing. You have had your effect. I do have one question that's been Skyped in. Do you realize that if the government didn't steal that money from us to begin with, we would have plenty of money to do all this? Oh, how well put. Yes, repeal the 16th Amendment. What a great idea. Well, I can't go into that because that would surely render this program helpless. We're not going to talk about that subject, but you're exactly right. Had we been able to keep all the money we rightfully earned, I guess we wouldn't be talking about needing money for these kinds of things, because the public would have it. Another question has been Skyped in. Do you think that there is clandestine space exploration going on? Well, I need only look back into recent months, just 2 months ago, a little program that had been toyed with by NASA for about 20 years, not with a huge budget, but, you know, in NASA's normal economy of scale, they were able to produce this little gem of a space shuttle called the X-37B. Now, it's a dandy little robotic, remotely controlled space shuttle. It can take a payload into space just like the space shuttle. It can place things out of its cargo bay and pick things up. It's a little bit smaller. It's sort of the sports car version of the space shuttle. But NASA ran out of money. And so in the classic style, they just kind of mothballed program after spending all the money that was allowed to them. And they, you know, made their reports and they impressed whoever they could impress. Then all of a sudden, in the nick of time, the Air Force shows up. Yes, the United States Air Force takes a strong interest in the X-37B. Now, the difference between NASA and the Air Force is economy of scale. NASA has a budget of about $170 million a year. It isn't a lot, which is why they use a lot of grad students. A grad student is a fancy word for slave. Someone who will do very high caliber work, long hours, so they can get that PhD under their belt or get some kind of resume to go with the PhD in hopes they get some tenure position somewhere. And the difference is that the Air Force has about $1.3 trillion to work with. So the Air Force shows up and guess what? They like the program and they take it over. And one other advantage, whereas NASA has to report and report and report, and they spend so much money reporting on how all the money was spent and who they bought this from and that from and every penny accounted for, and the Air Force doesn't. No, there's no budget review on the X-37B Air Force version. There's no budget limitations on the X-37B Air Force version. And so nobody knows how much it cost. And nobody knows what technology was put aboard, because the X-37B wasn't canceled. It was revived. In fact, it was put on the United States Air Force Rapid Deployment Program, which meant it had unlimited funds and unlimited resources poured into it. And sure enough, 2 months ago, the X-37B launched into space on a nine-month mission. It's going around space right now, going around our Earth on a nine-month mission, and nobody is reporting what that mission is. We can't find out what it is. We don't know what the mission is. We suspect that it is clandestine military surveillance, but we just don't know. We don't know if it's a weapon system that's been put aboard that craft or a surveillance system. No data available. So, when someone asks, do you think that there is clandestine space exploration going on right now, my friends, there are 72, count them, 72 major space programs going on. Bet you didn't think there were that many, but there are. Now, yes, they include things like the Voyager, and they include the Spirit and Opportunity and Mars's programs. They include the SDO and SOHO and Hubble. Of course, those are the ones you know about, but there are dozens and dozens that you don't know about, that are ongoing, that are active, that have crews and staffs manning them. And I have, on good authority, I'm going to put it that way, my source is personal. My source, I spoke to face to face. I did not get this by rumor. I did not get this by conjecture. This was a face-to-face question that was asked and a face-to-face answer that was given from someone in authority, a colonel, serving, active. I'm not going to tell you what branch. I'm not going to tell you where. Here's what he told me. We have been running missions back and forth to the moon for 12 years. This was a year and a half ago. We have been running missions back and forth to the moon for 12 years. That's what he told me. I believe him. There's no reason in the world he had to lie to me at that moment. He didn't give me any details. He didn't give me any direction on where to research to find out. But the man is in a position in that field to know exactly what he's talking about, and he spoke with authority. He's a full-bird colonel, and I believe him. He said to me, we are flying missions back and forth to the moon for the last 12 years, and that was a year and a half ago. So, the answer to the question, do I think that there are clandestine space explorations going on? Yes, I do. Because I have information to prove it. At least it's verbal and it was given to me face to face. And that's the only thing that I have. One of these days, we're all going to find out. But as long as the military is running things, I don't think we're going to know. I just don't. And I don't know why the military is so active in the moon without telling anyone. You know, we have a lot of amateurs out there with telescopes. Good telescopes. 8-inch, 9-inch, 10-inch, 12-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain telescopes with great resolution. Now, they're not going to be able to spot a spacecraft out there several thousand miles. They can spot the space shuttle up a couple hundred miles. But once you get out about 40, 50,000 miles, they're not going to be able to see anything that small. The resolution is a field of view much larger than that. You're also not going to find too many telescopes that can look at the surface of the moon with any kind of detail. Yes, we have 100-inch telescopes. I'm sure they can take wonderful close-ups of the moon. But you can't get down to the road and track level of the moon with a telescope from the Earth. You just don't have the resolution. You don't have the lensing capabilities. That's got to be something that's done pretty locally. Even the Japanese mission to the moon, where it took very detailed shots of the moon and strips around and around the moon, we got one controversial photo. One controversial photo where they stitched two photos together wrong, claiming that they had found a new crater. In reality, what had happened is they'd moved the stitch of the film, and someone picked it up and said, hey, that's a copy of this other crater over here. That doesn't belong right there. Somebody was smart enough to spot it. The question is, were the Japanese engineers who put that camera together and learned every square inch of where that camera went around the moon? That didn't do the whole moon, but it took a pretty good sample of it. They knew exactly where that photograph was supposed to go. They put it somewhere else. Why? What did that strip show, really, that they weren't supposed to show? Why did they copy another strip and put it into place, claiming to have discovered a new crater on the moon? But they didn't. They covered something up. We'll never know now, because that probe has long since crashed into the moon. It's not operable anymore. But maybe there are other probes going around the moon right now giving us even more detailed information. The question is, why? If we're the only race to have ever visited the Earth, why would we be worried about that? Well, the answer is, maybe we're not the only race that's visited the moon. Maybe it's been visited many times. And maybe it's been visited many times in Earth's past by Earth's inhabitants. And maybe it's been visited in the past by inhabitants from other places in the universe. And the moon was just a very handy place to observe the Earth long term. What's behind on the moon? What artifacts are laying there? If we have been smart enough to get there, who else might have been smart enough to get there? Great questions, and I wish I had the answers. I will do everything that I can one day to find those answers for you and reveal that to you. But maybe some of you out there have some speculation on that. 415-762-1161. 415-762-1161. You can join us. We can talk about it. We can discover together. We like it. By the way, at BBS Radio, they've created a new group conversation. You can call into this number and join as a group. I will give you the number, and we can try it out on this program anytime you like. It's 506-457-0232. I'll give that out one more time. This is a group conversation line. You can call into that line and form a group, and we can talk as a group on the air, live. 506-457-0232. And if you want to Facebook a bunch of friends and say, hey, let's get on X Squared Radio and let's talk as a group with Dr. Agnew out over the airwaves, the internet waves, maybe we can hit upon a discovery which will be breaking news to the world. Be prepared. Bring what you got. We'll talk about it right here on X Squared Radio. I will post that number on the website at xsquaredradio.com, and you can find it at channel 2 at bbsradio.com. Make use of it. Put a college group together or high school group together and give us a call during one of the programs, and we'll discuss anything you want to discuss. You want to discuss oceanography, we'll talk about it. You want to talk about cosmology and space exploration, be happy to talk about it. You want to talk about geology and what's going on in the world of oil exploration, or what's going on in the world of hollow earth theory or plate tectonic theory, be happy to talk about it right here. We may get Elizabeth Williams. She's at Stanford University, and her expertise is Arctic plate tectonics, to come on the program and talk about what the basis of plate tectonic theory is, so that you can understand why science accepts widely that we are continents floating around on Earth, not unlike cornflakes in a bowl of milk, on a layer of magma that is ebbing and flowing underneath the solid rock upon which we walk. And maybe why they still believe that plates subduct one under the other, creating the Pacific Rim of friction, which is where all of our, most of our earthquakes and volcanoes come from. Hard to consider another idea, that maybe the crust is expanding, and that just happens to be the areas of stitching where molten material fills in the gap as the crust comes apart. And I might say that some time in our development, the Earth was rotating much faster than it is now, and that would be supported by the calendar found at not Teotihuacan, but not Chichen Itza, Temple of the Sun, Machu Picchu, and areas like that. The calendar that was found, time is broken up into different components. We're talking about 22-minute hours, 30 hours in a day, and a year is made up of a different number of months. Anyway, if you consider that we go around the Earth in a fairly stable period of time, and that the Earth is revolving on its axis in what we believe a fairly stable fashion is, that means that the Earth was rotating much faster on its axis, and it also means we don't know exactly how long they measured a second to be. Right now, our minutes and our seconds and minutes and hours are based on base 60. 60 seconds to a minute, 60 minutes to an hour, etc. Well, they may not have had a base 60 system with 22 hours in a day, 22 minutes, 22 minutes in an hour and 30 hours in a day. That would be quite a bit less than what we see now. But if a second is measured at a different length, then maybe we're talking about a time period not so different than ours. If we are talking about a time period way different than ours, then we're talking about some planetary changes that are significant between when the original occupants of Bolivia made up that data and now. And it would also fly in the face of modern planetary core geology big time. We really would have no idea what's going on there. In our third hour, we're going to try to get Stanton Friedman to come on. His book is Science Was Wrong. He was scheduled to come on for 1 hour tonight. We hope we can get him on the final hour here at X Squared Radio. If not, then we'll try to get him another day. But I could use your help. My voice is a little tired. 415-762-1161. We'd be happy to have you on the program. We'll talk about anything that you want to talk about and discuss it right here. In the meantime, we are about 53 minutes into this hour, and so we'll go ahead and take a break right now, and we'll be back in about 4 minutes or so. Take a quick break, pour some water down my throat, change the chemistry of my body a little bit, and we'll be right back after this third hour of X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from North Carolina, July 25th, 2010. We're glad that you're here. I know you're out there listening, and if you're not, you're going to be listening to the archives while you're working on your favorite projects. Our phone lines tonight are open, 415-762-1161. I wanted to remind you that remembering the future, the physics of the soul and time travel, is for sale as an ebook at rememberingthefuturebook.com. Rememberingthefuturebook.com. And if you pick up the ebook, you're going to get a 25% discount on the printed version. And I have good news. We're finally through the editing process. It went to production. I should get the galley copy in about a week or 10 days. And as soon as I approve that, it is going to press. So you don't have much longer to wait for it to come out into print. When it comes out in print, it'll be everywhere. Amazon, Barnes & Noble, blah, blah, blah. But if you buy it at the website, you will get the audio version for free. And those of you that bought the ebook will have a 25% discount on the printed version, the audiobook, for free, and it'll come autographed. So I would make haste to that. Also, if you're trying to take advantage of those long summertime hours, you've been working a lot of overtime, weekends, things like that, you're making extra money, I want you to try to get out of debt. That's the way to go. But be sure to put aside a little bit of money, and then go to 1-800-PREPARE.com, 1-800-PREPARE.com, and check out the food storage and emergency preparedness items they have for sale there. This will keep you from being a burden upon the emergency preparedness or emergency response teams. Whether you live in the five states that are impacted by the BP oil spill or whether you live in other states, as we reported earlier tonight, 2,000 people in Tulsa, Oklahoma showed up to a shelter, a food bank, to receive food support, but there are only 375 boxes of food. Don't be one of the 2,000 that are burdening that emergency response team. Plan ahead. And believe me, your dollars will go a long way at 1-800-PREPARE.com. Start with a 72-hour kit and go from there. This stuff will last for 25 years without refrigeration. This is the stuff you need. It's lightweight. You can pack it. You can carry it. And it will save your life. And if you put in the code word Brooks, when you make your purchase, you're going to get an extra 10% off. 1-800-PREPARE.com, put in the code word Brooks, and start getting prepared. Also, don't forget to tweet. Don't be a twit, tweet. Go to X Squared Radio, jump on our Twitter account there, and begin following us. We put all kinds of interesting news on there all the time. We have roughly five Facebook accounts, so find one. X Squared Radio, North Pole Inner Earth Expedition, or Nippy Expedition, or Brooks Agnew. Join up with us. Stay close. We take care of that Facebook stuff every day. We realize how important the social networks are. And that's what talk radio really is. We have a social network between us. Now, yes, most of the time I'm doing the talking here live on the air, unless we have a guest. But you could join us at 415-762-1161, and we could talk about anything you want to talk about, as long as it has to do with something in science, politics, economics, history, political science. We'd be happy to talk about it here. The only thing we don't do is ghosts and goblins, and occasionally we'll talk about conspiracy theories if and only if the facts are well vetted. We carried on our discussion about moon exploration and clandestine space exploration. And someone Skyped into me and said, quote, I saw an interesting video that talked about how most or all space programs incorporate a red chevron into their logos. This is true. It's a little bit like the American flag. Also accommodates most of, accompanies most of those uniforms and outfits, and every single space shuttle mission certainly has an American flag on everything, or the flag of the nationality of the person that has joined the crew, that particular technician. The red chevron, I'll have to look into, because it is a symbol of solidarity that has to do with a broader organization, not just NASA. NASA is the blue field with the red jet trail in it, kind of a neat patch. Each mission has its own patch, and if you want to collect those, they're kind of cool. You can buy them on eBay, mission patch from every single one of those missions. They're very neat. They commission an artist and make a patch for each special mission. And there have been a lot of missions, let me tell you. You've lost track of them over the years. Unless you live in Florida and go down there on a regular basis to watch the launch, which is pretty spectacular, I hear. There have been a lot of launches, and now they're coming to an end. So we have Steve from San Diego on line one. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm doing pretty well, Dr. Agnew. I called in regards to your question. Is there a surreptitious space program going on to the moon that we don't know about? And my own feeling is that there is, because of the case of Gary McKinnon, a British subject who went into the Pentagon computers, hacked in, and he was prosecuted. They found him, and they started the extradition process during the Bush administration, and it's still being pursued today. There's people on the British side that are trying to protect them. But are you familiar with that case, by the way?
I'm somewhat familiar with it. I know that they've been trying to extradite him, and I know that there are a pretty strong grassroots effort there to keep him in the UK, which would keep him out of the hands of interrogators here in this country. It isn't so much that. It is the principle of the thing. If the Brits allow the U.S. to just extradite anybody who they feel is some kind of a cyber threat to them, it sets a terrible precedent of the U.S. being able to come in and pluck U.K. citizens out, take them to the U.S. and prosecute them. Now, the idea that somehow the U.S. had some kind of loss is beyond me. This was a guy, from what I understand, his own admission, this was a guy that used to get tanked up on marijuana, and then he would hack into these various databases, and he never saved anything. He just sort of remembered what he saw. So what kind of a threat is a person like that? Not really.
Well, I believe it's the information that he did present that they want to quiet down or suppress, because what he did find was a roster of U.S. extraterrestrial officers. And that's kind of an answer to your question. Do we have a surreptitious program going on? And I believe that's the reason that they're applying so much pressure to get this guy, because they have not done this with almost any other person who has hacked into a government computer. The reason they're after him so badly is because of that information, in my opinion.
Well, that may be true, and he may be an inspiration to others who aren't getting high before they get on, and who will save all the information once they hack in.
Well, I agree with you that they should not be able to extradite him. But we'll see what happens over the period of time. But have you ever heard of a man named Henry Stevens? He's written two books about German secret developments during World War II. One is about flying discs, and the other one is about a whole series of inventions. I recall one of them is even synthetic oil that Mobil is using the patents from.
I have heard of him. I have tried a couple of times to get him to come onto the program. I haven't been successful in actually contacting him, because that's the kind of stuff we really like to discuss on this program.
I believe that Henry Stevens' information is pertinent to the U.S. space program, because there's the chief person that was in charge of the German program was a SS general called Franz Kammler, and he disappeared right at the end of the war. And the speculation is that he sold the secrets in return for him being protected from prosecution at the end of the war. And the last U.S. operation in World War II, the last great, aggressive move that they did was send George Patton into what is now Czechoslovakia. It was the German city of Pilsen, which is now Plzeň, I think the Czechs pronounce it, where the German records were kept for the secret projects. And the U.S. did this just a few weeks before the end of the war. I think there was a Disney film that was made maybe 30 years ago about the miracle of the White Stallions. That indirectly concerned that operation. And it was intended to pick up the records of those Nazi secret projects and bring them to the United States. And from what Henry Stevens mentions, it was that they had already achieved speeds of over 2,000 miles per hour in these discs. And later on, there's a more of a phantom story about that Operation High Jump that you've heard about that may possibly be a connection with that, but that's not certain. But the other point I wanted to make is George Patton himself. He had that very untimely accident in Germany, was taken to the hospital with a broken neck and was recovering and expected to be released. And all of a sudden they announced that he had passed away, that he died. And I believe that the people in charge of these secret programs are so vicious that they do not hesitate to snuff out anyone they feel that might be a threat to secrecy.
Yeah, they want to keep everything secret. And that's exactly the kind of stuff that we want to go into here. We want to talk about that kind of stuff here on this program. And we'll keep making efforts to try to get Henry to come on the program. That he's obviously put together some very key information. I would like to talk, or at least vet some of his sources and make sure that he's got, you know, good hard evidence that you know, like pictures. Like we had Aaron Kaplan on this program, and he outlined a program whereby the first atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima wasn't built in the U.S. It was built in Germany, and it was actually
I've heard that, and Henry Stevens mentions that he's the one that found the records of it in I believe it was in the Baltimore shipyards. He had first requested information from the National Archives, and I can't remember the name of the submarine. I believe it was something like U-942, but I would have. I may have the wrong number. However, he got the manifest of that submarine when it was turned over to the U.S., and it didn't show any uranium at all on the manifest. However, he, by chance, gave the same request to the Baltimore shipyard, and he was able to obtain a manifest from there. And clearly on the manifest were 11 containers of uranium oxide. And he speculates that that was enough to construct not just one, but three bombs. And this is, I don't know how far the U.S. program was along I think most of the uranium is purified with these rotational devices. I forget, centrifuges.
They're called enriching devices, but this device was actually, the first one was detonated in Germany. It was a small one. It was detonated in an island off the coast.
Yes,
and,
I've heard that they, from what some people speculate, they actually exploded three devices already.
Right.
Before the end of the war. And the Japanese, if you ever saw the program on public television, they also exploded an atomic device off the coast of North Korea.
Well, the one that ended up in Hiroshima was actually built in Germany and slipped into the casing at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Yes, it's very possible. I thought that they had supplied only the uranium that was being shipped to Japan and then intercepted by the U.S. On the way. So then they delivered the shipment to Japan by via air. By
there wasn't enough time to build the device. It had to be already built. We had no trigger devices for this unit. That was revealed in the Oak Ridge papers. So
yes,
that was.
I understand that the Germans had perfected the triggering device.
Right. So there, the amount of evidence that's out there is just astounding. That there's a lot of clandestine stuff going on, and you're absolutely right. They are. I hesitate to use the word vicious. They're more like they don't want any loose ends out there. And so they would rather end a few human lives to save a lot of lives. I've just rewatched the movie Swordfish a few days ago, and it kind of brought all that to mind, you know, all those lines that John Travolta had in the movie that, you know, he would kill one person or 1,000 people to save the people of the United States. He would take out terrorists. He would demonstrate weaponry so beyond what any terrorist could ever respond to that they would just decide it wasn't worth harboring a terrorist, and they wouldn't even have a place to hide.
Well, it brings to mind the statements of some of the people involved in the Roswell incident that were threatened and told that there's a lot of people that end up in the desert without any identity and have their families disappear, et cetera, things like that. So I believe they've kept the lid on this project for so long. And the German project that was involved with energy from the ether, which I believe in this country Tesla also was working on, was an Austrian whose name I can't think of right offhand, but he used to work on farm developments and things, and he got interested in nature. He saw when fish were able to jump a height that he assumed was impossible just by muscle action. He tried to find the reason for it, and through his research, he ended up in this ether project, pulling energy out of the ether, and that would have been also one of the things that that the U.S. would have gotten from Pilsen, and. Where they've taken all those things that the Germans had already partially or successfully developed in the last 60 years is the big question. How far have they advanced from that time?
Well, that is a good question. And whether or not when you follow the money that's being put into these energy programs, like we talked about the Department of Energy tonight and the rhetoric that they use in the public. Oh, we're going to help small business. We're going to put hundreds of thousands of people back to work. This is the ingenuity of America, blah, blah, blah. And yet you read one more line into it, and then you inquire to the DOE, and then they write you back, no, that's not what we mean. What we mean is you have to have already been in the program in 2005 or you're not going to get any money. You're not eligible. You don't qualify. So they kind of hide it in the language of what they're saying. What we're really discovering is that most of the money that's driving this energy research is military driven.
I believe that also. I believe that the secret government in charge wants to keep business the way it is in order to extract the maximum amount of money from the sheeple, you know. And they don't want free energy, and they don't want energy saving. They want to continue to sell as much oil as they can for the highest price that they can.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I was in the oil business, and that's certainly what they want to do. Drill it, process it, and sell it for as much as the market will bear. Absolutely right.
I don't know if you're familiar with that Pastor Lindsey Williams. Have you ever heard of him?
I have.
Okay, yeah, he worked on the Alaska Oil Pipeline crew, and
right.
he more or less has come to that conclusion. And not only that, but he claims that they are the people that are really running the world right now.
Well, it could be. You know, we're watching BP right now posture their assets for sale, ostensibly so that they can raise the money to cover the amount it's going to take to fix the Gulf. But once BP sells its assets, there are no assets left to seize. BP becomes the largest Shell corporation, and I don't mean Shell oil. I mean Shell, like, empty, with no assets, no value in the world. And then
Dr. Agnew, have you ever heard of Peter Sutherland?
Yeah, I have heard of Peter Sutherland.
Okay, he is the CEO of British Petroleum.
That's right.
By coincidence, I believe that he just resigned his post at the end of last year, but he was the CEO of British Petroleum, and he was also the CEO of
Goldman Sachs.
What's the big not Goldman Sachs.
Goldman Sachs.
Goldman Sachs.
Sold 97% of his stock.
The big banking concern that got all the money from the U.S. So there's no danger of British Petroleum going out of business because they also control Goldman Sachs and they siphon off the money of the United States through the Federal Reserve System.
Well, we follow the money many times on this program, and we have determined that the disaster in the Gulf was definitely a disaster, but it was probably no accident.
Yes, I don't know what I've thought about it many times. I don't know what would be the reason behind it, but I think they know what's going on continuously. They reject aid to cap it off, and I really don't know the total plan, but it's obviously controlled by these powerful interests.
Well, I think one thing they didn't calculate on is the response of the social network. They really did not count on the American people, in fact, the global community, responding against BP and against Transocean for their movement of the money, for their actions. It's the one thing they didn't have in the Manila envelope. And so now the well is capped. Hopefully, it is going to stay stable. But now all the people know that there are 27,000 old platforms and abandoned wells in the Gulf of Mexico. 27,000 of them. I made the comment the other day that if a travel agent were to book tours to visit all of those platforms and you went to two a day, it would still take you 45 years to see them all.
Let me ask you this, Dr. Agnew. I know you were in the oil industry. Have you ever heard of those Russian wells that they drilled in the Arctic? They have, they say they have 11 of them. They drilled them to a depth of 40,000 feet, each one of them.
They're almost to 40,000 feet now.
40,000 feet is what they drilled into. And they got a pressure of 10,000 pounds per square inch. And each one of those wells continues to produce. In other words, they may have gotten down to where the oil is actually being produced by the earth through some unknown geological process. We always assumed that it was produced by the decay of vegetation and animals buried in the earth. But apparently, it is being formed by the earth itself for whatever reason or whatever consequence internally.
Well, they're still drilling. They haven't hit the mother lode yet. The problems that they're having right now are with lubrication. They've tried several different formulas. What happens is when the steel gets suspended down there about 42,000-43,000 feet, it cannot meet any friction in the hole, because if it does, it'll twist off the steel, because they're just holding onto a long-ass piece of steel that goes down in that hole. So they're experimenting with various lubricants to try to get the drill to cut the rock without twisting off the steel. That would be devastating and take months to fix, so they can't allow that to happen. So they're constantly going in and out of that hole to change bits and to change steel and to experiment with different things and to whipstock, to directionally drill down in those holes. And they are now down to, I believe, it's almost 48,000 feet.
Well, I know the Russians, they said they were down to 40,000 feet. And the one that the hole that the British Petroleum drilled in the Gulf was 25,000 feet deep. And what I heard is that the crews that were manning the station, they had recorded a pressure of 20,000 pounds per square inch before the rig blew up. Whether that's true or not, I can't verify, but that's what I heard on one of the stories.
I heard the pressure was 8,500 pounds and that the well was down to 14,400 feet. Those are the most concrete numbers that I've been able to get. And it does make sense with the pressures that they're getting at the wellhead now. I don't know why it's 1,800 pounds less than it should be. It could be because the trauma of the well flowing at that rate could have create like a diverticulosis in the ground itself. In other words, eaten away some of the rock in the 3 months to where it's actually sort of organically drilled its own hole under that high pressure off to somewhere else. And we could be looking at another leak somewhere else. Now, I did hear that another hole some 3 kilometers away is leaking 120,000 gallons a day into the Gulf right now.
Yes, that was my speculation. I was thinking about the same thing. Now, here's another question. If you take a globe and you know it's spinning and you fill it full of fluid, where are you going to get the greatest amount of pressure? Are you going to get it at the poles or are you going to get it at the equator?
That's a good question. It depends on if it's hollow or if it's, you know, honeycombed or whatever. I would say that the greatest pressure would be at the equator.
Well, that's because there's a big bulge in the earth at that equator. And if you check around, the earth, where all the major oil fields are, especially in the Middle East, where are they? They're not on the equator. They're fairly close to it. I believe that's because the oil that's being created internally in the earth is seeping through the earth's crust and coming up at that spot because the pressure is the greatest at that point. It's greater than what the Russians have picked up at the Arctic.
Most of the oil is somewhere around the 30th parallel. Not too much right at the equator. Most of it at the 30th parallel. Brazil in the south, Egypt or Saudi Arabia to the north, and Kuwait.
There must be a reason for that. There may be a way that the Earth is actually halved by internal currents of magma or whatever, and it might be that the oil can't come up directly at the equator, but slightly above and below it.
Well, there's some controversy.
Just speculation. By the way, also, the Edgar Casey prophecies about California going into the ocean around the turn of the century. When I first heard of them releasing this well, I thought, well, finally, there's a possible explanation. If the North American continent is floating on a pillow of oil, and you leak out enough of it, the continent would have to subside till it hits bedrock.
Well, I can tell you that there's enough deep earth, and I'm talking 75, 80 kilometers down, there's enough deep earth seismology that we're not floating on a pool of oil. And if oil was coming from that far down, if there was some abiotic source of oil in the center of the earth, then it would be coming up with very high levels of radiation. We do see some radiation in various places like Tennessee, some of it in the Gulf. It's probably 10 to 16 times higher than background, but not the kind of radiation that you would see if it was coming from that deep in the earth.
Well, I think it's not, maybe I didn't say it right, but I believe it's not that deep in the earth, but obviously, the Russians at 40,000 feet and the British Petroleum well at 25,000 feet, it's just barely gone below the crust of the earth or just...
We haven't even scratched the surface yet.
It's definitely not gone. The Earth is 25,000 miles in circumference, I believe, right?
Something yeah, the crust is probably somewhere around 800 miles thick.
Yeah,
we have
it's not that deep, but it's possible that the continents themselves, there may be pockets underneath where the pressures are varying, and that the Earth itself creates the oil in those pockets, and the continents float on it. And when every once in a while they'll shift, you know, when there's when there are things, external forces that would affect the Earth.
Could be
electromagnetic forces.
There really isn't enough data to support plate subduction like that on that kind of scale. I mean, they say that there is, but there really isn't. It's that they don't know. They haven't been to the Arctic. They haven't been to the Antarctic to take these kinds of measurements. They take other measurements, but not those measurements. There are places in the Arctic no one's ever been. Why, I have no idea, but they haven't been. And they haven't taken those measurements. So it's just a theory that this is happening, and I don't think that we should be looking for a never-ending supply of oil to burn in our gas tanks. I think that
I definitely think we should have switched years ago. There's another person, if you've ever heard him, he is a backer of alcohol, and he wrote a book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas. I can't think of his name right at the moment, but he told an interesting story about David Rockefeller.
Sure. Prohibition was passed and outlawing alcohol.
That's exactly the point I wanted to make. Just think of the different world we would have today if David Rockefeller had owned an alcohol distillery instead.
Yeah, well, I guess we wouldn't have much corn to eat then. We'd be growing the corn.
Have you heard recently there's a company in San Diego right here. They were far advanced into growing algae for making alcohol, ethanol. And it was very cost effective and would take nothing away from agriculture.
I believe
who bought the company?
Bacteria love to eat algae, and that is what makes the alcohol.
Well, this company here in San Diego was quite far along, but just a week ago I read sadly in the paper that guess which big oil company bought it?
Oh, would it be Chevron?
No, it would be British Petroleum.
British Petroleum bought them, and so now they're going to expand, right?
Well, I don't think they bought them in order to develop the process further. I think they just bought it in order to eliminate the competition.
Exactly what we see, too. Yeah, we built a nice biodiesel plant up in Washington State. Best in the country. Makes unbelievably clean ASTM spec biodiesel. It's been, it's been probably a little over a year since we built that plant. And we have not seen a hint of an order for a second plant.
It depresses me when I hear all those stories, and I certainly believe it because I saw it with my own eyes in the newspaper here just a week ago in San Diego. So that's where we're going, and I don't know how we can change it.
The only way to change it is for the American people to change it, and that means they're going to have to be informed. And it means they're going to have to elect people that will take the kind of action that the people want taken. And it means that they have to hold their politicians' feet to the fire and not listen to such things like I heard a week ago when a congressman leaned over to me and said, there's a reason why these guys are working out of their garage.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of these processes would have gone further if the inventors would have gone to someplace like Venezuela or Castro's Cuba with the development than if they offered it right here in the U.S. where it keeps getting squashed. That's just my opinion of the last few years. So, Dr. Agnew, I don't want to take any more time, but I wanted to bring up those points, and maybe in the future you could have Henry Stevens on the show. It would be interesting to hear. He's done mainly archival research, and I believe that one of the Joseph Farrell, the author Joseph Farrell, has used a lot of his research information to write his books, and he goes on to further speculation. But that might be an interesting thing to have on the show too. Interesting
we'll
person,
to get it.
Joseph Farrell. Thank you very much for listening.
Thanks for calling, Steve. Well, Earth Explorers, I know we talk about energy exploration and we talk about space exploration and we talk about the speculation one way or the other. And that's why we try to get the facts if we can. If I have actually worked in that industry, then I know for myself. If I haven't worked in that industry, then we're going to find somebody who has. We're going to talk about things as they make sense. In the industry and not make, you know, terribly wild conspiratorial statements. There is a way to get control of this. We are really at a turning point as a planet. We are at a point where we can decide with our future dollars, with our future planning, that although, you know, gasoline-powered vehicles have come into their own. I mean, they're as expensive as a house used to be. They're marvels of technology and communication and safety, and they're fascinating and wonderful to drive and fun to drive. We have to start thinking more responsibly about the planet, and that means we're going to have to start thinking about alternative fuels. Now, a lot of these vehicles will run on different fuels. They'll run on ethanol. They'll run on I know my truck will run on used transmission fluid. It'll run on soybean oil. It'll run on canola oil. It'll run on biodiesel, but there aren't many vehicles out there like that. You know, I have a hydrogen generator on my truck, which converts potassium hydroxide and water into hydrogen, generates about 2 liters a minute, which supplements my diesel fuel and makes the fuel go further. When I have that fired up and my chip is working correctly, I get about 23.5 miles per gallon out of a 3/4-ton diesel pickup. That's not bad. And the truck will pull a house uphill in a hurricane, people, so it's got plenty of power. It's not like you're going to run out of power. And when it comes to electric vehicles, you know, there's a lot of hype and a lot of misinformation out there about, gee, electric vehicles got to be able to go 300 or 400 miles. That's nonsense. Utter, complete nonsense. According to the Department of Transportation, the average personal trip is around 10 miles, less than 11 miles. The average commercial trip, 28 miles. With these vehicles often have onboard battery chargers on them. So you take your 10-mile trip, plug it in. Take a 10-mile trip, plug it in. You could do this for days. And, of course, the Vision vehicles come with, you know, other technology on them that allows them to charge up besides plugging it into the wall. Now, it's a lot slower, but you don't ever have to worry about your car being out in the middle of the desert without power. That's just never going to happen. It's just not going to happen. Now, you might have to wait a while for it to charge back up by the sun, but it will charge back up. The good news is you don't need an expensive charging grid to drive your vehicle. You can drive it anywhere you want, anytime you want. Just plug it in and go. You don't have to have a special charging circuit. Like your cell phone can plug in anywhere. You don't have to have a special cell phone charging station. You can just plug it in anywhere you want. Our phone lines are still open, 415-762-1161. We were talking about clandestine space missions. We were talking about the mysterious red chevron, and we really don't know what it means. We can speculate. I'll try to do some research on it and have that for you on the next program. My question to you is, do you think that NASA has been telling you everything? Do you think every manned trip that this nation or other nations have made into space have made it into the news? Do you think they're all publicized? Do you think that we have to strap ourselves to a hydrogen peroxide can and launch ourselves into space? Or do you think there's another way? Do you think there's been another way for a long time? You know, the ion drive engine, this is the engine that can launch a spacecraft with about a 1G acceleration rate. you realize that in a couple of months, you would be going at about 0.9 light speed, which means time for the craft itself would slow down. You could go to a star system 12 light years away in about a quarter that time by spacecraft time. So, yes, it would be a 12 years Earth time, but as far as the spacecraft itself, it would be less than the mission of a Mir, a term on the Mir. We've had those ion drives since the days of Eisenhower. Yes, that's right, Eisenhower. We have had the ability to propel a spacecraft in space at 1G for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, a never-ending, almost never-ending supply of fuel. And that was the original design. The actual true design, the modern design, would not pack so much fuel. We would be able to power the ship to a certain location, and then we would refuel at another star. We'd refuel at another planet and then fly back. The ion drive is sort of like a Mr. Fusion. You just have to put the right matter in it, like H3, which, by the way, the moon is full of H3. H3, a small amount of H3, would power a city. A coffee can of H3 would power a city for a year with energy left over. And the moon is rich with it. The moon has trillions of dollars of H3 on it. And it's only 250,000 miles away. It's a 5-day drive to the moon. We could have our own power supply on the moon, our own oxygen on the moon, our own water on the moon, safety from meteors, and be a mere 250,000 miles away. We could watch everything from a distance. And then you wouldn't have to worry about weighing 300 pounds, because up there, you'd only weigh 50 pounds. You weigh 1/6 what you weigh here on Earth. So why haven't we been back? What's the big deal here, boys? 415-762-1161. When are we going to get an executive in the White House with vision? Someone who can see something besides war and more war and giveaways and more giveaways. As I mentioned in the last hour, the parties in Washington are climbing over each other like dogs fighting for a media pork chop to see who's going to be first to give money to Americans who have exhausted their unemployment benefits, while at the same time passing a moratorium on all new funds to small businesses other than through grants at the Department of Energy. And we've already told you at the Department of Energy that if you didn't get a grant in 2005, you're not getting one now. No, tritium is not H3. That's a different compound. Tritium is one hydrogen proton, two neutrons. That's tritium. Deuterium is a hydrogen proton and a neutron, and regular hydrogen is a single proton by itself. Tritium is radioactive. It has a half-life of about 12 and a half years. It is a very small and cantankerous product, particle. It's hard to handle. We try to deal with it as a solid. It is often used to enrich fusion reactions, which unfortunately now are only weapons. We tritium enrich those by throwing extra neutrons into the reaction a couple of billionths of a second after the initial explosion. It helps the reaction become more complete, less waste product, more efficient. I wish we were as good about feeding tritium to a fusion reaction and using fusion reactors to make power, because then if we ever did have an accident, we wouldn't be dealing with 25,000 years of isotopes floating around in our water. It would all be done and over with in 12 years, 12 and a half years, the place would be clean. I mean clean, because the tritium would decay in that amount of time. H3 is a different product altogether. We're talking about three hydrogen protons put together but not fused into helium. So these are heavy particles. These are the heaviest protons in the universe. All kinds of energy in them. So H3 is a very... the moon is not radioactive in that manner, okay? This is a different compound altogether. It's in the soil of the moon, and it can be harvested. And it can make a lot of energy. A lot of energy. Clean energy. So, let's see here. I got one other Skype coming in here. Nope, that's Steve from China. So we're not going to talk about that right now, Steve. We'll have to wait till the end of the program. And we also have Alex in Salt Lake City that's been feeding us things. He asked me to consider a theory. The heavier a planet gets, the more hydrogen gas is retained, and they grow from planetoids to terrestrials to Jovians to brown dwarfs to red dwarfs and up until they end life as black holes if they don't explode first. What do you think? Yeah, normally white dwarfs are formed and brown dwarfs are formed from stars. Stars that collapse and don't explode will become brown dwarfs, or cooled off white dwarfs become brown dwarfs. But if they're dense enough, they can actually become black holes. They really need to coalesce. That means that they need to draw in more matter to them. And if you have a star that's four times as massive as our sun that collapses, you're basically taking the mass of those four times the size of our sun and compressing it to the size of our moon. Now what you've done is you've taken all that matter and you've crunched it into a smaller area, driving the density way up. Now, if you get any kind of gravitational body close to that, it's going to pull it in. And they don't usually hit head on. They sort of come together like ice skaters on the ice, grabbing each other and going around and around and around each other. We detect these with radio telescopes today, and they have been corroborated by the laser interferometer gravitational wave observatories around the planet. Those are the only gravitational wave generators that we have confirmed with these interferometers, and they hope to get them quiet enough where we can actually directly detect a black hole, but so far we have not. They are getting more and more sensitive. Areas of improvement are in control of the frequency of the laser so that the frequency does not vary. It doesn't drift. It stays very, very solid within a tiny fraction of a wavelength. The other is mirror flatness, the actual sapphire mirrors at either end, making sure that they're flat, making sure the splitting mirror is very flat. And the other two areas are in vibration control. These are in the wires that support the masses at the end of the tunnels so that the mirrors can be isolated from terrestrial vibration and also from evacuating all the air and molecules out of the tubes, so that there's no interaction between molecules on the inside of that. Now, as you know, that has to be drawn down to a vacuum in order to do that. They use turbine pumps to start with, and then a brush-type pump after that, and then an oil-type pump after that. Well, some of the problem is that you get leaks in oil seals, and then oil molecules leak back into the tube, and those have to be detected and then shut down so that the seals can be replaced, because if you suck oil back into the system, aspirated or gaseous oil, it gets on the mirrors themselves, and then you're going to damage the mirrors. So those are the areas of improvement, and they're now, I believe, down to about 10 to the minus 23rd inverse centimeters. So this is very, very, very small, a fraction of a proton, vibrations that they can detect. The theory is that if you have two equal laser beams that have been split and recombined out of phase, it creates a black spot. In other words, both light beams cancel each other out, hence the name interferometry. When gravitational waves come through our neck of the woods, they warp space-time. They stretch and squeeze the fabric of space-time, and when they do that, the laser beams have to travel a little bit further one way or the other, and you end up getting a signal. When we get that signal from coalescing neutron stars, it's rather high frequency, sometimes up around 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 cycles per second. That'll give you an idea how fast those bodies are going around each other out there in space. That's a whole lot of mass going a whole lot of revolutions around each other, and that ripples the heck out of space-time. So that's what they're picking up with those instruments at this time. That process is becoming better and better understood as the days go on. But I know that there are multiple pathways to reach those gravitational bodies, but the most widely accepted one is the death process of a star. It is rare, I think, that planets reach the size that they can collapse in on themselves and form black holes or white dwarfs or brown dwarfs, because they don't have the explosive force to counteract the density that made them a planet in the first place. That's one of the beauties of suns, is they've got this wonderful fusion reaction going on their surface, which is constantly trying to blow the beggar apart, whereas their massive gravity is holding them together. So it's a balancing act that eventually the fusion reaction loses. And that's what causes the star to collapse, a process which has been witnessed a few times. Obviously, the lifespan of a star is well beyond that of an ordinary man or even a generation of men. But we have seen several stars in those several stages, and we've speculated that that's actually the death process of the star. And it seems reasonable to me that that's what it is. Of course, then we have, you know, articles like we covered tonight, the giant sun that was discovered, and it's 265 times more massive than our own sun. We didn't think that was possible. So now the books are being rewritten. And as we rewrite the books, we rewrite our understanding, and then a new generation of astrophysicists and cosmologists come online, and we have a greater understanding, a greater appreciation for the data that comes in that refutes the theories and postulates that we already have. Now, fortunately, this is not a science that is mature enough that we have pews full of PhD high priests that simply won't allow a star 265 times the mass of our sun to exist. So that can't exist, then we can't consider it. But now, since we don't have pews full of these PhD high priests saying that it can't exist, we can accept that it exists. So that at least is hopeful, that we can consider it. We can, I was going to say believe in it, but we don't necessarily have to believe in it, because we have data. And now what we have to do is realize that the data is outside our paradigm. We have to create a new understanding to allow that data to exist. And as my good friend Stanton Friedman would say, we have to be able to have the integrity to say, isn't that interesting? That, I think, we need to study a little bit more. Whereas in times past, what we have done is said, well, that just simply can't exist. It can't be. And so we're not going to allow it to be. And anyone who says that it is that way, well, we're just going to drum out of existence, and you won't have a tenure track at this university. Sorry to say, that goes on every single day out there in the real world, especially when governments have all power and all funding for such research. Next week, we'll try to make up and have Stanton Friedman on here, and we'll talk about his book, Science Was Wrong. Every once in a while, we have miscommunications. People get busy. Summertime. Schedules get away from us, and things come up, especially when you've published a new book. All kinds of neat opportunities come up. So We will see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. Those of you listening to the archive, make sure to tell a friend. Get some more people to sign up for the archives. That helps us keep the lights on here with the BBS Radio Network. And don't forget to tune in to Web Talk Radio at the you can just go to X Squared Radio and click on the Web Talk Radio banner, and it'll take you there, and you can get the 30-minute version. Nice and fast, very high-paced, fast-paced, and high quality. So we'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.